Welcome to Holden Village, and today the lecture will be done by Kathy Bosch, and in the Creekside room she will be presenting this morning the Journey to Wholeness lecture. And she says, if all feelings are okay, what about anger? So let's go join Kathy now as she begins her lecture.
We're looking at Journey to Wholeness. And we're going to look at the kinds of ways we get to wholeness. I'm Catherine Bosch, and I'm a family life educator. And I'd like to share with you something about feelings at this time. But as we look at our journey to faith, I want to help you move with us in a kind of series of vehicles. And so we're going to look at the kind of ways we make that trip to journey to wholeness. And I think our faith life is one part of that journey. And you've got Bible study in the morning here and a variety of other things that go on at Holden Village and, of course, in your own congregations that helped lead us to that wholeness through faith. And part of faith's picture is also to remind us of that forgiveness that comes to us in the suffering and death of Jesus Christ. So those are some of the vehicles, and you'll find them all different shapes and sizes and forms. Here's another one, and that's to remind us that I'm lovable and capable. And as one gentleman in a marriage enrichment program that my husband and I were doing some years ago said, that really stands for I'm Lutheran and cuddly. So you can look at that too. We'll be dealing with some of IALAC, what sign we wear, and I think as children of God, we all wear an indelible sign from our Creator that we are lovable and capable. But sometimes in our journey to wholeness, it means that we may have to do something and change, and that's very scary. In fact, that's probably one of the basics for our feelings of anger that we're going to deal with today, is change. That's very scary. So we'll look at change. We'll look at the whole vehicle of thinking as an important one. What are our thoughts? What goes on in our heads, in our minds, when something happens to us? So we'll look at some of these today. We'll look some on Wednesday, and then again on Friday and Saturday as I continue this series. So, as we look at our IALAC sign, change, thinking, there's also feelings. What about feelings? Are we comfortable with our feelings? What we often have grown up with is that denial of feelings. Oh, you shouldn't feel that way. That's not right to feel that way, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Because underneath feelings also comes our self-talk. What do we say to ourselves when something happens? I'm a terrible person, or how stupid and dumb I am. What a terrible thing to do. So we'll look at self-talk today. We'll also look at it on a little bit more on Friday and Saturday when we deal with communication. What about the way I hear? What about the way I speak? The words I use, do I take ownership for my feelings or do I put my feelings onto someone else? Some part of that will come in today too. We've got, on that journey to wholeness, we've got our whole self. What's my self-image? What's my self-worth? What's my self-confidence? What's my self-esteem? How do I feel about myself? And that's what we'll be dealing with on Saturday when we look at I'm okay and you're okay. And as we deal with our whole journey to wholeness, the whole total picture includes how we deal with stress, the things that bother us, or sometimes that's anger. Sometimes it's just the nitty-gritty of living today and the challenges that come with it. What about our nutrition? Now here at Holden Village, we have quite a variety of foods that may be common to us or uncommon to us. But looking at our total nutrition, looking at how we exercise, and certainly here at Holden Village, we have all sorts of opportunities to exercise in our hikes and just plain walking up and down the stairs to your lodge or to the meals, maybe something too. Well, and my last vehicle is just left open for you to fill in. What in your journey to wholeness will fit into that last car, that last means of transportation, that last means of movement? So, in our journey to wholeness, there's a lot of ways that we move around. And we might start first, as I said, with our feelings about ourselves, that label that says, I am lovable and capable. I am Lutheran and cuddly. I'm learning about caring. Whatever you want to put those words together that looks very positive at the image that God wants us to be. So we'll look a bit at feelings and that part of it today. And one of the feelings that probably we experience whether we like it or not and whether we feel comfortable with it or not is that feeling of anger. And so we're going to put a good amount of our journey today on the vehicle of anger and feelings. So we can start with, first of all feelings are okay. That's a part of you. To deny your feeling is to deny you. And when we start to deny someone and say, oh, you really don't feel that way. You're really not angry. You're really not feeling depressed. You're really not fill in the blank. We're tending to deny that person. And what becomes confused is that we get the person and the problem mixed up. And that all feelings are okay, but how we choose to act on those feelings, and that's an important word. Because we do have choices. We're not puppets. Nobody stands out there with a remote control to click you into a particular feeling. Those are choices. But sometimes they're so automatic because we have such a history of experiences, what we were taught. I think we are not aware of how much that we have taken in quite by accident. Nobody has had a lesson plan for it, but we learn certain things from what we see other people succeed in. And so, for instance, as a child with temper tantrums, any of you ever throw a temper tantrum when you were little? No. You were all before that day. But you've seen children since throw temper tantrums, right? Okay. And we think, oh, all they need is, and we'll fill in the blank with our own special formula. But why do children throw temper tantrums? Any ideas?
They work.
Bottom line, they work. There's a couple of other reasons why young children throw temper tantrums. They don't really have a good verbal ability yet. They can't really say, when you say that about me, I really hurt inside and I feel disrespected and I don't want you. They don't have the language to say that, and so what they do instead is throw a temper tantrum to get your attention or to let you know that something's not right, and we most often don't catch on to what's not right, and we add more fuel to the fire of temper tantrums. So for many children, it's the way they can get some words out through a temper tantrum. And they will continue on with temper tantrums because they work. They succeed. If something doesn't work, we usually don't continue to do it. But if it works only every third or fourth or fifth time, we still might continue because maybe it's worth that every fourth or fifth time. Even if we don't succeed time one, two, and three, once out of every four or five times is still satisfactory. So, temper tantrums, because they work. We may continue to do a certain thing because it has brought us success. And until we figure out something about change, and that's one of those things that's rather difficult for us, we continue to do what we have learned. See if I brought that along. So I've just thinking about change and what we've experienced. This is sort of a fun digression. This is for all those who are born before 1945. That covers a few of us, not all of us. As we think about change, which is really very difficult for a lot of us, think about the changes we have experienced. We are survivors because we have survived these changes. If you were born before 1945, you were born before television, before penicillin, before polio shots, frozen food, Xerox, plastic, contact lenses, Frisbees, and the pill. We were before radar, credit cards, split atoms, laser beams, and ballpoint pens. Think about that. Before pantyhose, dishwashers, clothes dryers, electric blankets, air conditioners, drip dry clothes, and before men and women walked on the moon. We got married first and then lived together. How quaint can you be? In our time, closets were for clothes, not for coming out of. Bunnies were small rabbits, and rabbits were not Volkswagens. Designer jeans were scheming girls named J-E-A-N or J-E-A-N-N-E, and not the things you wear. And having a meaningful relationship meant getting along well with our cousins. We thought fast food was what you ate during Lent. Now, I've used this a lot of times with teenage groups, and they don't get that one at all, because fast food is really McDonald's and Burger King, etc. They don't even know about fasting. And outer space was the back of the Riviera Theater. We were before house husbands, gay rights, computer dating, dual careers, and commuter marriages. We were before daycare centers, group therapy, and nursing homes. We never heard of FM radio, CDs, tape decks, electric typewriters, artificial hearts. My husband has an aortic valve replacement. He was born with a defective valve, and it just got floppy, and his heart was enlarging. So they took out the valve and put in a stainless steel cage and a plastic ping pong ball. So as the heart beats, it goes up and the blood goes out, and then it falls back and closes. That was first in 1956, and he had his operation in 1973. Word processors, yogurt, and guys wearing earrings. For us, time-sharing meant togetherness, not computers or condominiums. A chip meant a piece of wood, hardware meant hardware, and software wasn't even a word. In 1940, made in Japan meant junk. How many of you drive a Japanese car? And why? Because it's not junk. And the term making out referred to how you did on your exams. Pizzas, McDonald's, and instant coffee were unheard of. We hit the scene when there were 5 and 10 cent stores where you bought things for 5 and 10 cents. Saunders or Wilson's or Bridgman's sold ice cream cones for a nickel or a dime. Even cheaper than here at Holden Village. For one nickel, you could ride a streetcar or make a phone call or buy a Pepsi or enough stamps to mail one letter and 2 postcards. You could buy a new Chevy Coupe for $600, but who could afford one? A pity, too, because gas was 11 cents a gallon. In Canada, overnight gas can change the equivalent of 11 cents a gallon overnight, sometimes up to 20 cents a gallon. In our day, cigarette smoking was fashionable. Grass was mowed. Coke was a cold drink, and pot was something you cooked in. And rock music was a grandma's lullaby. And aides were helpers in the principal's office. We were certainly not before the difference between the sexes was discovered, but we were surely before the sex change. We made do with what we had. And we were the last generation that was so dumb as to think you needed a husband to have a baby. No wonder we're so confused and there's such a generation gap today, but we survived. What better reason is there to celebrate? We have lived through lots of changes. Our home is in Waterloo, Ontario, which is in a very strong Old Order Mennonite community. And so we will see daily horses and buggies going by the front of our house. You'll hear the clip-clop. And downtown Waterloo and downtown Kitchener have garages in the parking, general city parking area for the horses to be parked while the people are doing their shopping. They don't have parking meters for the horses, but they do for the cars. So there are some people for whom change has not been in the same manner as it has been for the rest of us. But many of us, change is very scary, and sometimes that leads us to having a variety of feelings that are very uncomfortable for us. So we want to look a bit at what about these feelings and about the feelings underneath them that are anger. And I think first we might want to talk about anger and how it relates to all feelings. And anger can be described with the iceberg theory. Now, I haven't really seen an iceberg, but anyway, what I do know about icebergs is that about 1/9 floats above the water and 8/9 is below the water. 8/9 you do not know about. And that's about the same thing with anger. We can label this top part anger, but it's not the whole, it's not our whole being. And what we need to understand is that anger is a second response to a more primary feeling, something that's under there, under the 8/9. Now, think back to a recent time that you experienced anger, whether it was somebody who was angry at you or you angry at others, or if we can even take it another step further and say, I have a friend who, and it'll be on the outside. When you think back to that last experience of anger from someone else or from yourself, what might some of those feelings underneath it be? When I get angry, I often feel rejected. Or I'll feel frightened. Now, what might be some of the feelings that you can come in touch with underneath anger?
Frustration,
sure. Okay, what else?
Hurt. Mm-hmm. Disappointment.
Okay, disappointment, hurt.
Not respected.
Okay. Okay, that's okay, not respected. Rejected and not respected. Okay, I'll put both of them back. What else? Any of you ever feel embarrassed? I venture to say embarrassed is probably underneath a lot of our feelings of anger. You feel like you could just die, and instead of dying, you want to get back at them. Or because you feel so embarrassed, you want to get back at them. Well, there's a lot of feelings underneath there. Feelings of being left out, being frightened, being hurt, being afraid. So if we can get in touch with those... Thank you. Hold it in place. Okay. To get in touch with whatever that feeling is and to recognize that that feeling is okay, but I have some choices as to how I act on it and what I do about that feeling. And we often feel a little bit closed in or that we don't have the choices on that. And that anger is sometimes considered just something from the top of the head, but it isn't. All our feelings are embody all of us or are embodied in all of us. So we can look at when I'm angry, what are some of those basic physical symptoms that we have? Or when I see others angry around me, what are some of the physical symptoms that come in with anger?
I lose my appetite.
You may not feel like eating. You're losing your appetite. What else happens with you, within you?
Tense.
Feel very tense and uptight. Stomach starts to churn. What about face? You may get very flushed. It gets very red. You may start to cry. Your teeth may be clenched. Your face looks angry.
Strike out.
You may strike out. So, okay, so that may be some direct expression that we have to anger. We may yell. We may hit. We may throw. We strike out in some way. Okay, so that there's some physical symptoms inside, my stomach gets all tight, and I feel nervous, or I may just feel completely limp. It may be a variety of different things. What I want to free you is to recognize that anger is a whole part of me. It's not just something I'm thinking. The thinking may lead to the rest of the expression. And we may express it directly by hitting, throwing. Can you think of some indirect expressions that we may have of anger?
Withdraw.
We close the doors. We may eat more. We may drink more. Blot it out. Yeah, show it in indirect ways. Instead of being mad over here, I'm going to be mad over here at this person. And it doesn't get directed toward the person that is part of it. We may spread rumors. We may run away, slam doors. Okay, and then the feelings are what we just looked at on our iceberg theory. But there are also some passive forms of anger. We have direct, we have indirect, and some part of that indirect can also be a passive form of anger. Can you think of some passive forms of anger that you've experienced or you've seen in action?
Ignoring.
Sure. Ignoring can certainly be a passive form of anger. You're just not there. How about the kind of words we use to people? Sarcasm, ridicule, embarrassment. And we put the other person down, we put in the knife and we turn it. just squeeze it a little bit. Maybe refuse to talk at all. That could be a passive form. We may say yes to something and then just don't do it. Conveniently forget. Oh, did I say that? Oh, I couldn't have. Oh, I really didn't. Oh, I didn't know. Procrastination. Oh, yeah, I'll get at it. Just wait. And it just never gets done. Okay, so that we have a variety of ways in which anger is expressed. Anger is also called the mask of depression is also called the mask of anger. So one of those passive forms of anger may be just getting very depressed. Feeling life isn't just worth living. So how do we deal with that anger so that we don't have to get caught up in that depression or in using sarcasm or yelling and throwing and hitting? Well, we may want to look a little bit more at what actually is anger. Webster's Dictionary says anger is a feeling of displeasure resulting from injury, mistreatment, opposition, somebody disagreeing with you. It usually shows itself in a desire to fight back at what we think is causing this feeling. May not be the real reason that's causing it, but what we think is causing this feeling. And sometimes our anger, as was mentioned just a little bit earlier, we'll direct it at somebody else, and we think that's the person we're really angry at, and it may be somebody really over here. But it's just easier. This person is simpler to deal with. I can't yell at my boss, or I can't yell at my parent, or I can't yell at my spouse, or we have the can'ts or the shouldn'ts. Dr. Weisinger has written a book, and that's called Dr. Weisinger's Anger Workout Book. We don't have it here. We do have a book here in the bookstore, however, called Anger, the Misunderstood Emotion. Anger explodes virtually every one of our conventional assumptions about this crucial emotion and how it affects our lives as looking at this work. So that might be something if somebody is really working through the issue of anger or having to work with somebody who is a very angry person. That can give you some help. So Weisinger says anger is an emotion. Okay, we'll agree with that. But it's also a communicator. It's a cue. It tells us something is going on. It's a demand. Most often it's a demand that says, if only you were a little more like me, then I wouldn't have to be angry at you. You know, you need to be more like me, because I'm okay. And if I'm not okay, I mean, you've got to be not okay so I can be okay. And what we really want to deal with in our session on Saturday is the fact that it's not an either-or proposition. You can be okay and I can be okay, and that's okay. It doesn't have to be one up and one down. In a lot of relationships, it seems as if there's a learned behavior that's and a learned feeling that somebody has to be okay and somebody therefore not okay. There's got to be a scapegoat. And that's not exactly the healthiest kind of relationship. A demand. A demand that you do this, a demand for change, and that change is going to be on your part. Not me. I don't have to change. I'm okay. You're the one that's not okay. It's also an expectation. Expectation that you see me as okay, even though if you aren't okay, I've got to be okay. And that you meet my needs. I'm not really too concerned about your needs when I'm angry. Dr. Albert Ellis, E-L-L-I-S, has also written a book that's called Anger, How to Live With It and Live Without It. And he talks about anger as being temporary insanity, that our adrenaline rushes up and it closes off the thinking portion of our brain, and we do not think at all. We respond. We go on automatic from whatever we learned, whatever happened to work for us in an earlier part of our life, or whatever we see having worked for someone else, we go on and push an automatic button. Anger is a do-it-yourself process and a choice. Now, that's hard for a lot of people to believe. May I choose to get angry? Well, I think we do without being aware of it. I grew up, I do workshops in anger and have for the last 9-10 years. And I will tell people in my course, I've been a practitioner. It's not that I'm going to tell you something that just came out of research. This is my own experience, as well as reading what others have to say about it. Because I grew up in a family on a farm in southern Minnesota where you had this big grove of trees out behind the buildings, and if you got mad at somebody, you could probably do a lot of good indirect expression of anger, and instead of yelling in the house, you could go out and you could pick up pieces of wood and slam them against a tree and break them, and you could, you know, use up your energy in that way. And then if that happened to be your day to pick up the wood for the wood stove in the kitchen, you could just go out and pick up all those pieces. So it had a practical aspect to it as well. But there was a way to get those feelings out in a in a way that was not hurting another person. You didn't have to hit and kick and slam and punch somebody else. You could go out and nobody hurt you. Well, I happen to live in the city now, and I raised 2 daughters in the city. With houses right next door. Right now we live in a condominium townhouse, so I've got, you know, walls on both sides or other people. You know, I can't do that. I have to find other ways to deal with my anger. Second part about that was that when I married someone who had grown up, of course, in a very different family. Have any of you ever married somebody that's grown up in the same family? You have? So they have some different experiences, right? Well, my husband grew up in a very loving, caring home, and it was one home where never was heard a discouraging word, and the skies were not cloudy all day. You could have very good, positive feelings, but you could not be angry. You know, God wouldn't love you if you're going to be angry. Mother and Dad won't love you if you're going to be angry. I often put up graffiti sheets on the wall with people come into my class and have them have some labels. One of the headlines in one paper is things I learned about anger from my mother, from my parents, knee, and other joints. And I'm surprised at some of the things that come out, and some of these comments, God won't love you, mom and dad won't love you, you'll never get to heaven. And all these have come out. Those are the things that they learned about anger. And so you begin to stuff it. And I think it's Albert Ellis who also says, every time you get angry and you tend to stuff it, you're just not, I'm not going to deal with it, I'm not going to let it get the best of me, it's like swallowing a lead marble. Not just an ordinary marble, but a lead marble. Lead's very heavy, and this is swallowing a marble, and it sits down in your stomach, and it sits there, and you get angry again, and another one comes and joins it, and pretty soon you're all weighed down with this anger, and you're really hard to move around because you're so filled with anger and something has to come out. We don't want to talk about stuffing it and keeping it in and just never letting it out. But on the other hand, letting it all out and yelling and screaming and throwing things and smashing things and doing all of that other kind of release that some people say let it all hang out is not very healthy either. You can get arrested for one thing. You can have a stroke or a heart attack and the whole process of it. But there are other things that anger also leads to. I said that anger, depression is often called the mask of anger. We also look at migraine headaches as being one thing that might be triggered by anger. Obesity, low self-esteem, drug addiction, ulcers, stroke and heart attacks, sexual dysfunction, and even colon cancer. Now that's interesting that it's connected basically with colon cancer, not other types of cancer. We had a good friend who had just finished medical school, who died at the age of 43, and he would have said, excuse me, he died of colon cancer. And he said, basically, he was dealing with anger. His mother died. He lived with us while he was in university. And his mother died when he was doing some graduate work of a type of cancer. And his father sort of fell apart over his wife's death. And so this fellow didn't respect his father because he didn't stand up strong. But he also was mad and angry with God that his mother died. And she should not have died. And so he was dealing with a whole lot of anger. And he had this idea about it, and he finally did go through and discover some research that had been done linking anger specifically to colon cancer, which was his problem. But also as an environmentalist, which was his first occupation, he was also had an environmental sensitivity. He could not stand a lot of smells and such. He did not think he could survive an anesthesia, so he did not go through the surgery for colon cancer, and he died at age 42. So it's not just a feeling that we need to figure out one way or another. It's something that really affects us and affects a lot of people around us. A lot of marriages and a lot of families are dysfunctional because anger has not been worked through, and somebody becomes a scapegoat, and that's not a healthy situation. Your self-esteem is way down, and you feel, I don't have any reason for being. So we want to recognize that there is a way to deal with that anger. It's a choice. It's also, you know, if it works, it's a learned reaction to frustration, a habit, and a tool for change when it challenges us to become more of an expert on the self and less of an expert on others. So that's some basics about anger. That we can deal with and come to some understanding about. But let's see what the big picture is. What about anger and my whole response to it? And we want to look at what trigger is inside of me. There's basically three components to anger: what we think about, how we respond, what our behavior is, and our whole body response to those two. What does our body do? There are basically three ways in which most of us tend to respond to anger. We either fight, we take flight, or we submit. And I want to look at a fourth way, and that we can find a way to deal with it, to be able to diffuse it, to be able to figure out when it's starting and it's just mild annoyance before it gets up to rage. And part of that is our self-talk. And I put that as one of our vehicles for our journey to wholeness. What do we tell ourselves? Do we tell ourselves I'm lovable and capable? Something happens, do we tell ourselves what a stupid idiot I am? Or do we say, that's a stupid thing to do? Is there a difference between labeling the person and labeling the action? Can we deal with the action and not deal with a label for the person? That may have been a dumb thing to do, but that doesn't mean you're dumb. It's just we made not a good choice. We didn't have enough information. But when I say you're dumb, that papers you dumb forever and ever, amen. And it may have been just that little activity, that one action that was not helpful. So I don't want to put a label on you that you're going to have to live out in other activities, when it just may have been that thought, that choice that you made at that time that was not helpful or had consequences. So what do I say to myself when I do something that's not helpful? Boy, what can I learn from that? Now, if we catch it down here, we can probably say that. But if we're way up here at rage, we're probably going to say, stupid, dumb idiot, and blame somebody else. If we can get at that bottom and to recognize you can't learn less. Can you all say that? I can't learn less. I can't learn less. It means you can always learn something from whatever has happened. You can learn not to do again another time. And in some situations, you can learn what to do again another time. Thomas Edison, the inventor of the light bulb, when someone heard that it took him something like 1,400 experiments before he finally succeeded with the light bulb, someone said, wasn't that terribly discouraging, 1,400 failures? And Edison said, no, it was a 1,400-step process. What if he had stopped at 276? We'd still be going around with candles, or somebody else might have taken up. But think about that the next time you think, oh, I've tried that how many times and it doesn't work, I'm just going to give up. Well, we may have to learn something more about it, get some more information, fill in the blanks. How can we reframe, reword what we've been saying to ourselves? And can we say, that was not helpful, or that was a dumb thing, rather than I'm stupid, I'm an idiot, I'm a whatever, or you are a whatever. So we want to also look there at that concept of ultimate responsibility. How often can we act instead of react? Isn't it true? We get angry over similar situations. It's not that sometimes they're one of a kind. But sometimes it's something that continues to go on. Now, I've said I've really worked. My husband and I have been married 34 years. 35 years. And so when I discovered that he didn't have some of the same experiences I did about anger, I really had to begin to do some changes, or we wouldn't still be around at this time together, at least. And so one of the things I had to do was reframe some of the words that I said to myself and learn when not to get angry or when to give a word of warning. And at one point, I recall one of the things that I was really very irritated and annoyed about was when we would go into a new situation where he knew the people and I didn't. And we would come in there, and he would put his hand on my head and say, this is my wife, Catherine, with a K. Now, the name Catherine probably has more ways of spelling than any other name available. And I don't care whether they spell it with a K or a C, and even if they spell it with a K, it can be spelled several other ways, and not usually the way mine is spelled. So I don't care how my name is spelled, and I couldn't stand being patted on the head. But I also realized this was not a situation where I'd say, get that hand off of me, I'm not a kid. So I would stifle it for a while. But I also have a problem of selective remembering. And so I'd probably forget about it after it all happened and when we'd be alone. And so this went on for a period of time. I don't remember how long it went on, but an uncomfortably long time, until finally we were walking up to the door of a house where an event was happening, and I stopped outside and I said, just a minute. When you introduce me, I don't care how my name is spelled. You can put your hand around my shoulder, you can put your hand around my waist, you can hold my hand, or you don't have to touch me at all. Just do not put your hand on my head and pat me as if I was 4 years old. And he said, do I do that? And I said, yeah. And he said, okay. And he hasn't done it since. He wasn't aware of what he was doing. And since I kept forgetting to check with him or to say, I don't like this, when I thought it would be a better time alone, it continued to happen. So sometimes you have to look ahead and act, not just react. And another way is to keep my button, not to give it away, as we often do. Let somebody else determine how I'm going to act. Another very common story is when our children were young, and it was still before drip-dry clothes, and my husband was in campus ministry and had a lot of meetings or would go off to visit students, and I'd be home with the girls, get them into bed, and then I'd see that basket of laundry that needed to be ironed, and his shirts were all ironable shirts and so forth at the time. And I'd sit down and iron. Now, I used to be a 4-H club agent, a home economics agent out in Minnesota, and I used to give demonstrations on how to iron a shirt in 3 minutes. So I wasn't really bothered about ironing, but there was just nothing else to think about. And so I'd think about all those things that got done that shouldn't have gotten done, all the things that didn't get done that should have gotten done, and everything else that fell in between. And I'd get all uptight. My self-talk was not very positive at that point. And by the time he'd come home, I'd have all sorts of things to, you know, it was that gunny sack that would just explode. I'd stuff so much into it, it would just explode. And after a while, now, I didn't iron very often, so this didn't happen every day. But it began to happen often enough, and he began to say, "You've been ironing." And I said, "Don't change the subject." I finally had to realize he was right, that it always happened, this kind of blow-up always happened after I was ironing. Now, I happened to be teaching a marriage and family class at Syracuse University at the time, and when I came to this realization, I said to the class, "I've decided to stop ironing." And a 21-year-old co-ed in the background said, "You can't do that." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Well, you've got to iron clothes. You've got to..." I said, "Well, I can always iron quickly something that's needed right at the moment, and then I'm thinking about what I have to quickly do and how much time it's taking, and I don't have time to think about getting angry and all this other leftover stuff." But she was really upset that I was abdicating my role as a female to do the family ironing. Well, a niece came to live with us at that time, too, to start university, and so I just turned over all the ironing to my niece, who just would sing away and listen to her music and had a good time, and I had a lot less, fewer blow-ups. But, you know, how do we keep our button? How do we act instead of react? How do you begin to deal with it? And recognize what's underneath. Now, you probably have some other things that get you very irritated and annoyed. How do you begin to deal with them? Another time, I was teaching home economics in a junior high in Syracuse, New York. And a bright young student came to me one day to have me sign her out, and I realized she was leaving school, and what I saw on the slip was that she was leaving to go to the YMED programs, the Young Mothers Educational Development, which meant she was pregnant, ninth grader. And she was a good student. I couldn't imagine. I mean, she was not... There are some kids in that class I could have expected to get pregnant. I did not expect her to get pregnant. And I went home. At that point, our daughters were 12th grade and 9th grade, and I started to give my lectures to my 9th grader. And all of a sudden, my 12th grader said to me, "Mom, Sarah's not the one that's pregnant. Your student is. Why are you getting mad at Sarah?" Well, those were important words of wisdom. All of a sudden, I had to check myself, and I was reacting, not acting. I mean, my lecture was not needed in that situation. So the more I react, the less the other has to be responsible for his or her actions. So that's taking more self-responsibility. Well, what do I have control over? Well, I can interpret my sensory information. What do I hear? What do I see? Touch, taste, smell are other ways we get information. But most of it is what I hear and what I see. And often we take that information that we see and hear and we interpret it in a way. We think about it. What is it really saying to me? What are they really saying? So a very simple illustration could be, I'm walking down the hall in my office And it's not a very wide one, my office building. And a coworker is coming the other direction, and she's got some papers in her hand. And I say, "Good morning, Mary," and she just walks right on. And I look back, you know, we practically touch shoulders. It's not that wide of a hall. I don't think I was hoarse, you know. I don't think I did anything to make Mary mad. You know, what's going on? So what I could take in is that I didn't hear her say anything. I saw her. I thought she saw me. Not too sure about that. I said something. She didn't respond. So what's that interpretation? She stuck up. She doesn't like me. She thinks I did something wrong. We could fill in the blank with some other things. So how does that influence my emotions? Well, I'd feel what? Not respected, rejected, embarrassed, left out. So what do I want? Maybe I want to get back at her. Next time she walks down and talks to me, I'm just going to walk away and not say anything to her. That could be a passive force of anger. So how do I choose to act on my feelings or emotions and wants? I may decide, well, I'll just play the game the way she has. But I may also go back over again and say, well, I did see her with a paper in her hands, and maybe she's got a client that she's really concerned about, and she was going to see her and trying to quickly read through before she goes to pick her up in the reception area. I work for a counseling agency. So I may have to go through that again and say, well, she was preoccupied. Maybe she didn't hear me. So then I could interpret it, well, she's busy. She didn't hear. It has nothing to do with me. So my emotions are not irritated or annoyed, just sort of puzzled maybe, or, okay, she's busy. I'm not going to interrupt her. So what I want then is the next time I'll see her, I'll start all over again. Mary, how are you? You looked really pretty preoccupied this morning. Did things work out okay? And so I could say something. I could take more responsibility for my feelings, my wants, and my actions by talking it out with her. You know, I saw you this morning, and I noticed that you were really very preoccupied. Is everything okay now? And I don't have to play tit for tat and be mad back at her and say, well, what a snoot you are. Won't even say good morning to me. So I do have some things that I can have some control over and to take some responsibility for. And so we may look at, as we learn to deal with anger, look at these four elements. What's going on in my body? What's going on in my mind? What am I feeling? What have I learned about anger in my life? And this particular situation that's generating the anger. What information can I give myself so that even if it's after the anger's over, a lot of people will say, well, when you know that there are things that are angry times in your household, how, especially with children, how do you set some bottom lines for anger? And the bottom line I would not set would be, don't ever be angry. Maybe because that's denying your feelings. But to figure out what am I really angry about, what's the feeling underneath my anger? And so to be able to own that, take responsibility to say, I'm angry and fill in the blank. I'm angry and embarrassed when you tell that story about me in front of other people. That's private information. Or I'm angry and feel rejected. I feel angry and rejected when I come into the room and you look up at me and then change the subject or look away and don't talk to me. So I need to take some ownership and to share that. I feel like a little 4-year-old kid when you pat me on the head as you introduce me to somebody. I don't like that feeling. I would like. So it may be dealing with a situation when there's no anger, when you're feeling okay and the other person's feeling okay and you're thinking brain is turned on, not off. It's hard to deal with anger in the midst of it all because, as Albert Ellis says, our thinking brain is turned off. So you might need to do a timeout. I need to think about this. I need to take a walk. I need to cool off. I need to go to get a cup of tea. I need to go splash my face with water. I need to go to the bathroom. I need to run around the house 5 times or walk around the block. I would suggest, however, if you're really angry, don't get in your car. A friend of ours, professor at the seminary, was very angry about something and got in his car and was driving out to the country and was on a country road, did not see a stop sign because he was so angry, and got plowed into by a truck. The truck driver said, when he got out, "I didn't think anyone could survive this." Now, the fellow happened to survive with very few scratches. His car was totaled. He survived. The truck driver survived. But the truck driver was sure that no one in that car could have survived. And the fellow said, "I will never get in a car when I'm feeling irritated or annoyed, because even that irritation and being annoyed can build up, and your thinking brain is turned off, and you're not really being as careful." Walk. Do some exercises. Listen to some soothing music. I wouldn't listen to heavy metal or hard rock. You can even pound it even deeper into it. What's soothing? Figure out what you can do. Often when I have a group of a family group, I'll have us do a circle. And do you know the old camp song, "If you're angry, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands"? Okay. And I'll have them sing that a couple of times, and then let's switch it. If you're angry and you know it, what might you do? Well, everybody, the first thing they suggest is stamp your feet. Okay, is that acceptable in your household? Now, if somebody's going to stamp their feet and you don't like it, you were taught in your household that you never stamped your feet, you're going to get angrier, right? So you may have to agree with what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. Is it okay to stamp your feet? Maybe it's not okay to slam doors because it may break the glass in them. Can you stamp your feet? Do you get one of these wiffle bats that the air goes through it so you're not really hitting anything, or a sponge bat? You know, what is acceptable? Some people find it very uncomfortable to have any kind of physical, so they won't allow hitting on a pillow because then the next thing they can hit on you. That's okay. Set your limits. I feel very uncomfortable if you're hitting on something or you with this bat. But, you know, do some exercises. If you want to get out that energy, what's acceptable without hurting another person or property? So set your limits. Be aware. So with the whole family, decide when we're angry, what can we do about it? How should we deal with it? Can we set it as a general expectation that when you're angry, you say, "I'm angry," and figure out what's that bottom, the basic primary feeling underneath. I'm angry and afraid. I'm angry and disappointed. I'm angry and hurt. I'm angry and feel rejected. What is it? And I need to work this through, but I may need 10 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour of timeout time, and then we need to talk about it. Let's do some problem solving with it to figure it out. But you can only begin to do that if you catch it early. If it reaches up to rage, you're not even going to be able to think about a timeout, and you may have to just plain use some signals and each plan to go to your own space. I forget who it is that suggests when you have younger children that you use a fuss box. And that may be, you know, an appliance box you cut a door into, and you can put some pillows inside it. And even parents can go in there. But when you're really upset, instead of throwing a tantrum in the middle of the kitchen floor, you can go and sit inside this box and you can hit the walls, or you can cry, or you can moan, or you can take deep breaths, or you can say, "I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm still lovable and capable. No matter what you say or do to me, I'm still an okay person." That might be a good mantra to say when you are really angry. No matter what you say or do to me, I'm still a child of God. I'm still a worthwhile person. And that our faith and forgiveness are there as the basic. That I can be forgiven. I can forgive. Goes both ways. That's why the car has no front or back on it. Another way of looking at anger is what might call a solution-focused approach to anger. How would life be different if you were able to control your moods, your anger, or your response to somebody else's anger. How would life be different? Is what's happening now what we want to continue to have happen? Sometimes people might say it does because it gives them a sense of power and control. It's my way or the highway. Have you ever heard of that? Some of us live under that as a kind of rule. And that's not healthy for a relationship. So we want to look at a solution-focused approach. What do I need to get along with or to keep out of trouble or to have fun? What would be helpful and what can work for all of us? Maybe there will be some things that will overlap and some things that are not going to be helpful, and you may have to try to stay away from those unhelpful things and find more space in that overlapping. When I change my response to you, quite likely you're going to change your response to me. If somebody starts to get angry at me and I get angry back, we're both going to get really heading on up. If somebody gets angry at me and I say, wow, you really feel strongly about that, or something is going on here. But if I were to say, you're upset, they're probably going to get angrier because I haven't heard them at all. Or I've completely undercut it. So I may not want to get out and throw my hands in the same way that they do, but I want to give a statement back that says, I understand where they are. You're really angry and embarrassed about what just happened. And then they can either confirm it or correct it. Now, I'm not embarrassed about it. I was really frightened that something was going to happen. Oh. And then you can deal with those feelings. And once you feel heard, then those feelings tend to lower and to lessen, and your thinking brain opens and works again. But if you don't feel understood, if you feel somebody's just closed the door in your face, you're going to bang on that door even louder if you feel like fighting. Or you're going to run away even farther if you feel like taking flight. Or you're just going to feel, I'm just not worth anything at all if you're the one that submits. If we can choose that fourth option instead, to work it through, to deal with it, to figure out how can I approach anger in a way that can be a solution, that can help my life and help the life of the other person to be that life that God has meant us to live. Then we can work through it and we can deal with it. So we want to look at attacking the problem, not the person, not even attacking ourselves, because that just uses up our energy that could be used more for solution rather than putting down and frustration. So we want to find anger when it's at a very beginning basis and to deal with it so that we have indignation, yes, but indignity to the other person or myself, no. We come out being the victor and not the victim. And I think, in a sense, we're all survivors, and that's what we want to do within dealing with our feelings, too, that we can survive in a very positive way that says, I am lovable and capable. I am a child of God, and with that, I have the conviction that I know I am forgiven and I can be forgiving.